Welcome to RTN Theology. I'm Bob Crawford. Richard Rohr said, "The theological virtue of hope is the patient and trustful willingness to live without closure, without resolution, and still be content and even happy because our satisfaction is now at another level and our source is beyond ourselves." Martin Luther says, "Not by reading books and speculating, but by living, dying, and being damned, make a theologian." And old Erasmus of Rotterdam, one of my favorites, said, "It is the general accepted privilege of theologians to stretch the heavens, that is the scriptures, like tanners with a hide." It is my hope that once every other month, you and I will be able to get together to talk about God, faith, and religion. Joining us in conversation will be theologians, philosophers, politicians, business leaders, and artists, each sharing their own theories, ideas, and personal anecdotes. On our show today, we welcome Christian philosopher James K.A. Smith, who is currently professor of philosophy at Calvin College, holding the Gary and Henrietta Biker Chair in Applied Reformed Theology and Worldview. And a little bit later, Ian Scotta joins us with a report about researchers in Sweden who have discovered Arabic characters woven into burial costumes from Viking grave boats. The discovery raises new questions about the influence of Islam in Scandinavia. And we'll close out today with a visit from my old friend David Childers. We'll discuss some of his gospel albums and some of his favorite songs of the Christmas holiday season. But first, this being a theology podcast, I thought it would be appropriate for me to share a little bit about my own faith journey with you. I was raised in the Catholic Church. I went to CCD, catechism class, every Sunday. I was baptized, did penance, made my first Holy Communion, and then was confirmed when I was 16. From there, my family essentially stopped going to church. So did I. When I got a little older and out of high school, I completely fell away from organized religion. I would go as far as to say that I became hostile towards the church. I thought of religion as a way of lulling the population into submission. I looked around at the world and world history and thought about the enormous toll wars of religion had taken on human life. And I thought it was all a big sham. In my late teens and early 20s, I was drawn towards Greek philosophy and Buddhism and Eastern religions. But the truth is, it was a very selfish time for me. I was constantly searching for something, but really anything that would bring me temporary pleasure. I began to view the grand end in life as getting a good job, having a successful career, and having a family. By the age of 40, I had accomplished all that. But then, tragedy struck in 2011 when, as many of you well know, my daughter Hallie, who was at the time 22 months old, suffered a brain tumor. For some reason, one of the first things I did after arriving at the hospital was gather our friends and family together to pray for Hallie. A few weeks before, when our family was leaving our house for our annual beach vacation, my wife Melanie said a little prayer in the van, but there was nothing in me that I saw or I could see where I was truly coming back to God. In the days and weeks that followed, as Hallie spent 6 weeks in pediatric ICU at UNC Chapel Hill, and then 6 months at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, I came into a real relationship with Jesus Christ. A good friend of mine gave me his grandfather's rosary. Another friend brought us a Catholic prayer book that taught you how to pray it. I began praying the rosary in Hallie's room in the intensive care unit 4 times a day, sometimes more. As my faith continued to grow, it was nurtured by many friends. The fact that Hallie's still here with us today on this earth is a miracle. But you know, conversion's a funny thing. You give your life to Christ, and it's everything changes and nothing changes. Life is a battle, and it kind of gets to be more of a battle once you come to faith. C.S. Lewis said that man doesn't know how bad he is until he's trying to be good. The kingdom is lived day by day through interactions with our spouses, with our families, with our friends, the customer service representative on the other end of the line, with those we judge and those who are judging us, with our culture. Our first guest knows all about the interactions between the city of man and the city of God. James K.A. Smith. He's a professor of philosophy at Calvin College, where he holds the Gary and Henrietta Biker Chair in Applied Reformed Theology and Worldview. Smith is an engaged public intellectual and cultural critic. He's the author of several books, including his most recent, Awaiting the King, which is the third in a trilogy on cultural liturgies. He's also the author of many op-eds published in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and most recently in the Washington Post. Jamie Smith, welcome to RTN Theology, and thank you for being our first guest.
I'm so glad to talk to you, Bob. Thanks so much.
Well, before we begin, I have a confession to make. I know you're a Reformed guy, and the sacramental Catholic aspect of penance isn't really your thing, but I was thinking you might be the perfect guy to help me out.
Yeah.
So every day, and I mean every day, I watch the news, and I see something, and I hear something that the president did or said, and it just kind of blows me away. Then I look on Twitter, which is probably a terrible mistake, and I see evangelicals coming out of the woodwork to defend him, and we're really seeing this right now in the Alabama Senate race, where evangelical supporters of Roy Moore are using the Old Testament in some respects to justify alleged behavior by Moore some 30 years ago. I say to myself, these people aren't Christians. And if they are, they're practicing bad theology, or worse, they know exactly what they're doing and they're enablers of these men. And these men, in my mind, when I'm condemning them, are they show no fruits of the Spirit, right? So I'm just all fired up. But then in minutes, my Catholic guilt kicks in. And I realize that my anger, my bitterness, my frustrations towards these people is as bad as what I perceive that they may have done in the first place. So my question to you, or my request, or what I'm looking for from you as a man who spent years studying church and culture is help me understand the kingdom way of dealing with the reality that we find ourselves in today. How does a citizen of the city of God reconcile themselves to these times?
First of all, I think you're right. And it's almost like we have to sort out or sift out the difference between it's not my job to sort out the eternal destiny of other people. Do you know what I mean? That it's Jesus who sorts out the wheat from the tares ultimately. However, I do think that we are called to be discerning and to name and critique and denounce and resist the ways in which Christianized or Christianish ideas get deployed and enlisted for goods and agendas that are clearly anti-Christian. Do you know what I mean? So I guess probably where I'd want to go with the conversation is, how could we perhaps explain or understand the way in which even people who think of themselves as Christians can nonetheless fall prey to all kinds of ideological idolatries? And my account would be, it's because we practice our way into those. We step into the political sphere, and we imagine we're going to go in there and we're going to sort of like, quote unquote, take it back for God, or we're going to, you know, take this country back, or some sort of trope like that. And maybe there's even a kind of original biblical intuition about that. But we totally underestimate how much the dynamics of the political sphere can co-opt us. So I think what we need is a better account of how and why Christians in the public sphere get co-opted by other rituals, other practices, other ideologies, not because they're convinced by it, but because we kind of practice our way into it without realizing it. Does that make a sense as a start?
It sure does. And it really, you know, it's funny. I figured we would talk about this and then talk about your recent op-ed in the Washington Post and then talk about Awaiting the King, your most recent book, which is a part of the Cultural Liturgies Project that you've been working on for many, many years. But this is all the same thing, right?
It is. It's all intertwined. Yes.
So this is what you call in your book and what is essentially political theology. And I don't know how many of my listeners really know what that is.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and maybe one of the things that we should do is sort of like, first of all, calm anxieties. One of the things that worries me sometimes is people will immediately hear the term political theology and think it means theonomy, right? Oh, well, this is how theology is going to take over politics. And that's not what we're talking about. What we're saying is there is a long tradition of Christian theological reflection on public life, political life, our life in common. And in fact, the most sophisticated political theology is exactly what keeps us from imagining that any one people or party should take over the public sphere. So yes, political theology is not something that should freak people out as if this is exactly what the religious right is doing. Political theology is exactly what you want if you want to make sense of and undercut the agendas of both a fundamentalism of the right and a fundamentalism of the left, perhaps.
So in your op-ed that I think came out on Thanksgiving Day.
Yes.
The NFL's Thanksgiving games are a spectacular display of America's God and country obsession. And in it, you kind of address the protests that have been going on in the NFL, but they've been, shall we say, exacerbated and redefined by the president who inserted himself into the conversation earlier this year. But what's really cool about your op-ed is that it takes a 30,000-foot view of nationalism, which is kind of what we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
And what's really great is you write in the op-ed, when the Constitution functions like Scripture and the pledge serves as our creed and the flag is revered like the cross and the national anthem becomes our hymn and the hand over heart is a sacred expression like the sign of a cross, then a swelling patriotism becomes our religion and dissenters are heretics.
Yeah, so for me, when you look at the vitriol, and let's remember what Colin Kaepernick and others are protesting, which is precisely a legacy, a continued legacy of injustice towards especially African Americans in this country, police brutality. It's not, and when you look at the way, of course, he expressed that is ritualistically, you could say, and it's a very, in many ways, it's a very respectful mode of ritual protest to take a knee. But and why is it so loaded? Why does he get such vitriolic responses? Because in fact, he could discern that the beginning of any NFL game or the beginning of every NASCAR race is in many ways this liturgy of nationalism in which the colors of the flag and the pageantry and militarism of the national anthem and this the whole litany and ritual of it is precisely how we reinforce this mythology about American exceptionalism, kind of congratulate ourselves on our justice. And by challenging the ritual with a ritual response, Kaepernick realized, I think he discloses that we're nationalists, not because we're convinced by arguments, but because we're conscripted by these sorts of liturgies. And then if you look at the way people respond to that, it's clear that this is not just about politics, right? This is a religious response. He's treated like an infidel. He's treated like a heretic. And I think that unveils how much, for so many Americans, allegiance to country is so mixed in and up with a kind of vague allegiance to God that in many ways, allegiance to country trumps, unfortunately, it overtakes our allegiance to distinctly Christian goods and ideas. And I think we need to realize that if we get suckered into nationalism as an idolatrous ideology, it's because we've kind of practiced our way into it through these rituals that happen every Friday night under the lights of every high school football game that keep reinforcing this story. And before we realize it, we are captive to a story other than the gospel.
So is it that the game, and if we just, we could take many examples, but using football as the example here, is it that the game's been hijacked by these, like you said, these ritualistic notions of country and God?
And I mean, there's a reason why, like, when you go to the symphony or the ballet, they don't start with the national anthem. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's why do our sporting events all start with the national anthem? I think there's probably something going on there about the nature of contest and conflict and the battle of the game. And so now we just accept that as part of the repertoire of what frames these kinds of events. But it's also because they're some of our biggest events. I mean, where else do, you know, 60,000 people gather? You go to Bristol in Tennessee for a NASCAR race, and there's 100,000 people inside this arena that has to make you think of the Roman Colosseum in so many ways. So it's not that we're learning to worship the teams. It's that this battle on the field is now framed by these rituals of national identity. And if we're not aware of it and see that those aren't just something that we do, they're doing something to us over and over and over again. And that's how we get conscripted into this disordered sense of our national identity's importance. I mean, to be clear, I don't think we shouldn't confuse nationalism with a rightly ordered patriotism. Do you know what I mean? And then there's all kinds of ways in which one can be committed to one's country without that turning into a blind nationalism in which everything serves the end of that country's power and interest. I think there's an important difference between those.
What age are we in? I mean, is this postmodernism right now that we're a part of still, or is this post-truth? Like, what is this? Because when you say, well, to me, it sounds like you're saying we can separate nationalism or patriotism from, to make it not so toxic, or to make it not such a fine line, a tightrope, where if you don't practice it just the right way, you know, where a protest can be patriotic. And in our country, protests in the past were patriotic in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But today, with this, the climate, which, please help define it. Is it post-truth? What is it?
It's interesting. I think there are definitely ways in which it reflects a kind of postmodern age where it's almost like we're given license to ignore or write off those who differ from us and write off facts or inconvenient truths that we want to ignore. I still think it's probably most helpful to think about this in terms of actually our secularity. I think this is still very much a manifestation of the fact that we find ourselves in what Charles Taylor calls a secular age, which is not an atheistic age. It's not an unbelieving age. It's an age in which you have this explosion of multiple different ways of believing. And in many ways, I think that kind of age is what makes the rise of a strong man possible. I think it's when other modes of believing are diminished, and especially when people find themselves in sort of desperate straits existentially, it's not surprising that then they are primed and ripe to foist onto some strong man who arises all kinds of religious-like hopes and expectations. There's a little bit of a a mythology of politics becoming our savior, and this politician will be our savior. And I think that partly explains it. By the way, I think that that washes over on features of the left as well, so that I think there are modes of progressivism that equally sort of over expect from politics. And it's almost like when you inhabit the world as a secular space and there's no transcendence and no eternity, then anything that's going to be changed depends on us entirely, and you kind of start to over, and politics becomes ultimate. And I'm not sure that that's always healthy for actual lived public life together either.
So the challenge of this interview and this conversation is to inform and educate, and I'm going to just go out on a limb here saying that a lot of my listeners aren't familiar with Charles Taylor. So
if
you could briefly kind of tell people who he is, what his work is all about, and then explain for them his concept of the social imaginary.
Yes. Okay. So indulge the philosophy professor here for a few minutes. Okay. So Charles Taylor is a Canadian philosopher who wrote a really, really significant and widely engaged book simply called A Secular Age. And in A Secular Age, Taylor tries to make sense of where we are now in the West and when we are. And in some ways, his baseline question is, how did we go from a world in 1500, in which it was virtually impossible not to believe in God, to a world in 2000, where, especially in kind of our elite culture-shaping centers, it's virtually impossible to believe in God? It's a 900-page book, so the explanation is very long. But I think what we would be interested in gleaning from it for today is, he says, what characterizes a secular age is not that it is atheistic or identified with disbelief or unbelief, but that what is believable has changed. There's a shift in what he calls the plausibility conditions, so that what we take for granted, what we treat as believable, what we assume, has shifted significantly and is really fractured and pluralistic. And so that nobody can treat their belief system as axiomatic and the default. We live in an inherently pluralistic society. We live in alongside people on our street who believe all kinds of different ultimate things. And so we experience that deep pluralism. Now, what Taylor says is that that happens not so much on a level that we think through, but on this register of what he calls our social imaginary, which is his way of trying to say we all kind of have a feel for the world. We all sort of move through our lives and we're animated and oriented by some kind of story that we carry in our bones that maybe we've never made explicit, maybe we've never articulated, but all of us have something like that, some way that we imagine the world before we ever think about it. And because that's sort of submerged and unconscious for us, we often don't understand our deep disagreements because we've never dug down to the level of our differences at the level of the social imaginary. Does that make sense? Does that help?
It does. And for our listeners, you wrote a book called How Not to Be Secular, which is basically not Cliff's Notes, but a way of you talk about how we can understand Charles Taylor.
Yeah, it's a gateway drug to Charles Taylor.
A drug indeed, Charles Taylor is. So let's talk about the Cultural Liturgies Project. Awaiting the King is the third in the series. Is that the final, or is that just...
It is.
Okay.
So it's a trilogy.
That's
it's
all.
It's like Tolkien.
It's Tolkien. There you go. So let's go back to book one, Desiring the Kingdom. Let's talk about that. Yeah. Can you explain what you... Well, first, you know, what you set out to accomplish with the Cultural Liturgies Project, and then how Desiring the Kingdom sets up the trilogy.
Yeah. So actually, in many ways, I think the project was trying to explain your opening question. in this sense, I was trying to make sense of and explain why Christians in North America seemed to be so similar, or the why so many Christians in North America did not seem very different from everybody else, particularly in our public lives and our political lives. So in many ways, I was trying to make sense of our assimilation to disordered modes of public life. And why was it that Christians who thought they were transforming culture ended up getting transformed by the culture? So the opening volume, Desiring the Kingdom, tries to get at that, though, by really trying to understand what human beings are in a new way. And what I suggest, just very briefly, is instead of thinking about human beings as thinking things who sort of make their way in the world by thinking through everything as if we were these brains on a stick, that in fact we're not as rational as we think we are. We are actually animated and oriented and driven by what we love, by what we desire, but by what we long for. So think of human beings not as brains on a stick, but as hearts on the run, so to speak. And in that sense, what really animates us and drives us and orients us is our loves and our longings. But, and then here's the key piece, what we love, what we long for, what we desire is not something that we kind of think our way into. It's something that we practice our way into, that our loves and our longings are sort of inscribed in us and shaped in us by the practices that we give ourselves over to. So I call those cultural practices that form our loves liturgies. Just to help everybody realize that I think all human beings are religious, whether or not you confess a particular institutional religion. I think all human beings are religious because we all long for something ultimate. But what we learn to love is very much an effect of the practices, the rituals, the liturgies that we give ourselves over to. And it's important to realize that their liturgies are not conscribed or confined to religious institutions or buildings. In some ways, the mall down the street is a liturgical space. It's a worship site, because by being immersed in its rhythms and rituals and patterns and practices, that's how I become a consumerist. That's how I kind of practice my way into imagining that stuff could make me happy. Or similarly, the rituals and liturgies of nationalism, the way I come to love my country's identity, my national identity, as if it was ultimate, is not because I reach that as an intellectual conclusion. It's because I've been conscripted by the liturgies that sort of have trained my heart to love that as ultimate. So if you realize that we're lovers, that we're desiring creatures, that we're liturgical animals, then you start to be aware of your liturgical immersion in new ways. And then the constructive piece, and I'm speaking as a Christian philosopher, a Christian theologian, is within the Christian community, we need to be more intentional about the liturgies, the practices of our churches, precisely so that they are shaping our hearts to love what God loves, to long for the shalom and justice that he wants to see characterize creation, and not co-opted and conscripted and assimilated to these other rival liturgies.
And a lot of this is grounded in the thinking and the philosophy of St. Augustine.
Yes, absolutely. Everything, all my best ideas, I ripped off from Augustine. He's my homeboy.
And I guess with that respect, I should reference another book of yours, You Are What You Love.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. You Are What You Love, in a way, is trying to be the sort of more popular, accessible articulation of that argument. Desiring the Kingdom has a lot of footnotes. But that kernel of this Augustinian insight that you are what you love, that our hearts are longing for and chasing something ultimate, and that those are shaped by the practice we're immersed in is kind of more succinctly captured in You Are What You Love, right?
So then let's go to the next volume of the Cultural Liturgies Project, Imagining the Kingdom.
Yeah, so this is where and this is where our work maybe intersects a little bit, in the sense that I argue that if we are lovers who are shaped and primed by the practices and rituals that we're immersed in a sense, that also means that we are fundamentally aesthetic creatures, right? Like we are, we absorb this way of being in the world through story, through image, through song, through legend. And there's a way in which we have these aesthetic heartstrings that are played on by film and novels and poetry and music. And that gets at something of who we are. It's precisely why advertising, for example, advertising does not try to give you information about a product. It's very hard actually to find an ad that gives you information. Instead, what it does is it paints a picture of a world through the power of a concise story. And by doing that, it sort of plucks these aesthetic strings in your heart and is subtly making you want to go there and to live into that story. And so a lot of that is about arguing why the arts are so significant, why they can capture us at such a fundamental level. And then the question is, of course, to what end? It's how advertising hoodwinks us into being consumerists, but it's also why the history of the church has always been a patron of the arts, because it's precisely sort of how you tap into people's imagination.
Yeah, I got to say, Pope Gregory got that one right. For
yes,
sure.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
So then, I mean, is it foolish or is it reasonable for us to be watching a movie and to be viscerally moved by a scene in a movie, and can we connect that to God working in this world? I mean, is art part of God's, does God have a hand in this? I mean, can we really look at a secular film? I mean, I took a class at Fuller, and it was theology and television, and we watched Luke Cage, the Marvel Netflix series, and we watched, I mean, everything from Breaking Bad to Mad Men, and we just kind of looked at it from a theological point of view, and the question of, you know, is this God working? I mean, the idea of Assyrians in modern dress, right? Is this the way we can look at art today?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes it's not always a matter of looking for God in film, say, but it is certainly the case that film can be a conduit of that. But also, I mean, redemptive film, illuminating revelatory film can just show us the truth of the world, right? And absolutely. So in my intro to philosophy course here at Calvin, after we read St. Augustine's Confessions, I have them watch the film American Beauty. Do you remember that? It's complicated a little bit now because of Kevin Spacey. But in many ways, American Beauty, I think, is one of the most powerful portrayals of the kind of existential search that Augustine was talking about in Augustine's confession, in his confession. So absolutely. Or even this morning, I was talking about the problem of evil in Augustine. And Terrence Malick has this old film called Thin Red Line, a war film, in which there is this episode or this scene where one of the soldiers, you know, he's just dealing with the darkness and the horror of war, and it turns into this meditation on evil. And he's asking, like, this great evil, where did it come from? How did it steal into the world, robbing us of life and light, you know? And it actually, that dialogue gets folded into the beginning of a song by Explosions in the Sky, which is really cool. But so, yeah, I'm a huge fan of engaging the arts, not to instrumentalize them, not to sort of like clamber over them and get to God behind them, but to say the arts speak to us on this imaginative register that breaks open the world for us in ways that we couldn't see it if you were just reading a philosophy or history textbook.
I got a question for you from a pastor, a friend of mine who's a pastor. I told him that we were going to speak, and I asked him if there's anything that he would want to ask you. So here's the question. It seems like typically Reformed people like yourself mostly talk about culture as art, while Anabaptists, Yoder and Hauerwas, mostly talk about culture as politics. In your opinion, how should the church appreciate and reconcile, or should it just hold the tension between both these rich traditions in practical ways that guide our cultural lives while being apart from the world?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I would say my particular stream of the Reformed tradition, I actually think we try to talk about this in multiple ways. So for my money, it's almost like you have to think of our cultural analysis as refracting culture through a prism. And what unfolds there is this rainbow of all kinds of different spheres of being human and being in community together. So that politics and art would be part of that. But I would also want to talk about families and economics and science. And, you know, I mean, like there's, I hope we're refracting the entirety of that. And when I'm talking about, in imagining the kingdom, when I talk about our being aesthetic creatures, I'm not necessarily just saying that the arts are the province of that. It might be a particularly intense example of that. But to go back to our opening conversation, for example, why do the liturgies of nationalism co-opt and conscript us? Because somebody's not walking up to you and saying, here's the 15 reasons you should be a nationalist. It's because you are caught up in this drama of a display that is visual and aesthetic and affective, and you see it and you're singing it and you're hearing it, and it's got a tune and it's got this visuality about it. And when the helicopters fly over, you know, and it's pounding on your chest, all of that is affecting you in this aesthetic way. So I think there's a way to bring all of this together, but also realize that the aesthetic actually affects all of these. There's an aesthetic aspect to politics. There's an aesthetic aspect to economics and so on.
So you talk about O'Donovan a lot in Awaiting the King.
Oliver O'Donovan, yes.
Yeah, can you introduce him to our listeners?
Yeah, so Oliver O'Donovan is a British theologian and ethicist who writes prose that is notoriously difficult and opaque. He kind of writes like a Puritan. And yet, I think he is one of the most important voices in political theology for us to try to understand where we are and when we are. And in many ways, by the way, he also is indebted to St. Augustine. So we're all kind of living in this long shadow of Augustine, who in many ways in his City of God wrote the first political theology, so to speak. O'Donovan, I think, helps with the history of Western political institutions and helps us to see and discern how they are indebted to Christian and biblical ideas, and also where they have diverged from them. So a lot of the work I'm trying to do in the new book, Awaiting the King, is try to translate the difficulty of O'Donovan's insights into something that's just, I'm trying to bring them down to a little bit lower shelf so more people could appreciate them.
Something I found really interesting when you talked about Yahweh's kingly rule.
Yeah.
You say,
yeah,
we need to look at the features and terms associated with Yahweh's rule in order to discern just what God's will is for flourishing human society. What are some of the political concepts that are embedded in Yahweh's historical rule?
Yeah. So part of the, if I could just zoom out for a second, what O'Donovan is arguing is that in many ways, the institutions and practices that we take for granted in Western liberal democracies like the United States, Canada, Britain, whatever it might be, those institutions and practices of liberal democracy are in some ways an effect of the impact of biblical understandings of justice, in the history of the West, kind of making a dent on our political lives. And so he's, and what O'Donovan is suggesting is, if you really want to understand what liberal democracy is trying to preserve, guard, achieve, and chase, you need to see that it's, in many ways, it's a vision of justice that's informed by this biblical legacy. And so he looks to Israel. It's also why there's a very, very important conversation to be had here between Judaism and Christianity and liberalism. He looks to Israel and he says, what you see in the ideal of Yahweh's reign, of God's reign, is, for example, you read the biblical prophets, Amos, Joel, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and what you see is, for example, a vision of flourishing that is for all, right? So that there's a sense it's not prioritizing the powerful over the weak. If anything, it's almost flipping that. It's realizing that the weak need to be guarded and protected, and we need to be attentive to widows and orphans and strangers, so that, because they are the vulnerable, they are the marginalized. And Yahweh's rule looks like a king who attends to widows, orphans, and strangers or immigrants is really what we're talking about, because Yahweh, God, realizes that they are the most vulnerable and most prone to being treated unjustly. And so he looks out for them. And what you see in the Old Testament is God constantly praises those kings, those rulers, who exhibit that same kind of concern for widows, orphans, and strangers. So that would be one example. I mean, there's more. O'Donovan also talks about the fact that Christ, Jesus Christ, is a representative for all of humanity, translates into actually theories of representation in liberal democracy, so that now the king is not the mediator, earthly rulers are not the mediators of divine presence, Christ is the only mediator, and that's why we want democracies that represent us adequately. It's a much longer story, but that gives you a couple tastes, maybe.
So what is your advice? Do you have any advice for Christians who've kind of, like, again, to take it back to the very beginning of our conversation, who say, yeah, I'm done.
Like, yeah, totally.
I see what's happening with Trump and with Roy Moore, and yeah, no one's standing up. I mean, like, people, like evangelicals are just, they say, well, Trump's a baby Christian. We just need to pray for him because he's, you know, or people who consider Trump like this secular ruler who's going to save the chosen people, or they're that God sent. And I'm sure God has a hand in Trump in some way. This is a moment of redemptive history. But what do you say to the evangelicals or the just Christians who are like, I'm done. I'm going to the desert. I'm leaving the world,
yeah,
so to speak.
Yeah.
I'm just turning it off. What do you say to them?
So I want to say a couple things. First of all, I want to affirm and I'm trying to think the cagiest way to put this. I totally get the frustration, and I think the denouncement and the bastardization of Christianity in all of this is something that has to be named by other Christians. So I think we need people who are bold enough to call this out for the idolatry and hypocrisy that it is. But we now, okay, so then we have to ask, how did this happen? And that's where I think we need people to realize that we kind of practiced our way into this. We got assimilated to these cultures where winner takes all, and winning for a party was more important than allegiance to the truth. I think that's the Alabama situation is just so mind-blowingly despairing to me that the only way I can make sense of it is you have this 40-year history where people were convinced that this party was God's party. And so now whatever it takes for the member of that party to win is somehow doing God's business. And the long trail of bad decisions that characterize that thinking is disheartening. Now, however, to the people who then want to just pack it in, throw it away, I would say this. Please don't, because if people who don't have a healthy biblical vision of what it looks like to care for our neighbors, to build institutions for flourishing, to build policy for the marginalized, if those people don't continue to commit to political life, the vacuum is going to be filled up by nihilists and power-hungry grabs for winning and domination. And so my biggest concern about Christians retreating at this moment is that we actually are giving up on our neighbors and we're giving up on the vulnerable, because the best thing that we can do to attend to the vulnerable and the marginalized is to build good, just, healthy institutions that are stronger than any particular person. And if we evacuate, if we leave that, if we go to our deserts, if we go to our islands and holy huddles, those institutions will be taken over by those with disordered loves. And so I think it's a missional obligation for us to figure out how to be, as James Davison Hunter puts it, faithfully present in the midst of all of this disorder and hope for continued reform.
Okay, now I'm going to ask a question or two that I'm sure to edit out of this interview.
Okay.
What do you say to the voter who says, well, it's all about abortion? My question is, being someone who came from the left and then in 2015 said, you know, I just don't line up here anymore in my life. So I became independent, becoming more conservative. And then when I could have been more of a conservative, the conservative party fell off the other side.
Yeah, totally.
And so I actually heard this conversation on television this morning. Is it kind of the Democrats or the liberals' fault for not offering someone who's pro-life more of an option?
I do think that's part of it. So I should also say, so I'm Canadian. I am in the process of becoming a citizen right now. But I, as a Canadian...
Bad time. You picked a bad time
to do that,
by the way.
I know. But I want to be able to vote in the next election. As a Canadian, the sort of single issue politics of abortion in the United States has just always befuddled me. So I don't necessarily have the best read on this. I would say, for the most part, I'm cynical about it's all about abortion, because I feel like that's what Reagan was already leveraging to kind of sucker conservative voters to then also end up favoring policies for the rich and the wealthy. So you get all kinds of people who vote against their own interests because the Republican Party has convinced them that abortion is the be-all and end-all issue. So I'm just cynical about that. On the other side, I do think, and this is a point that Michael Ware has made, I think the Democrats are guilty of being equally fundamentalist about this issue. And by not making room, I would probably be a pro-life Democrat if that was possible. I don't fit, and I'm not at home in either party, but that's probably closer to the constellation of concerns. But that creature is not allowed to exist in electoral politics in the Democratic Party. So I think for the most part, we have to figure out how to get people to realize there is no such thing as single issue voting. No candidates have actually done anything beyond hand wavy things to even change this. And that if it's really about reducing abortions and preventing unwanted pregnancy, there are a million better strategies for us to do this than just voting for a certain kind of candidate. That's about the best I've got.
Well, this whole interview has been the best ever. I really appreciate you. But before I let you go, you know, I'm a student of theology. I'm going to just imagine most of my listeners are. So give us some homework. Give us something that we should be reading.
So, and I'm going to suggest somebody other than St. Augustine, because I'm just going to assume that everybody should be doing that.
What I was going to say was after we all read St. Augustine's Confessions,
yes,
what
good,
should we read
good.
Next?
Yes. So here's some. So off the top of my head, and maybe I would think of a different answer later, but I would suggest a thinker who still, I think, is not well-known or broadly known, named Abraham Kuyper, K-U-Y-P-E-R. He was a Dutch prime minister. He was a theologian. He ran a newspaper. To me, Kuyper is kind of the Christian Renaissance man. And the reason why I think he's so timely is he had a really robust vision for the presence of Christians in public life, collaborating with those that he disagreed with, forging life in common. At the same time, he had a really robust vision for kind of theological depth and rigor. So Abraham Kuyper, to me, is somebody that would do well to be reading. And there's a little book of his that I think would just be – you would love it, Bob. It's called The Problem of Poverty. And to me, it's a tiny little book he gave. It's a lecture he gave in the late 1890s, I think. And in The Problem of Poverty, you will see a Christian theologian thinking through what he calls the social problem. And it's really the problem of inequality. And I just think so many people would find it refreshing that this is what a Christian public voice could look like. And it's so much more nuanced than what we hear today.
Jamie Smith, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much, brother.
Thanks so much. It's great to chat with you.
Come with us, abide with us.
A researcher in Sweden believes she may have found evidence that could change our understanding of Viking culture. Of course, her findings and their ties to Islam aren't without controversy. The Road to Now's producer, Ian Skata, filed this report.
Decades ago, in Gamla Uppsala, Sweden, researchers unearthed the remains of a woman adorned in colorful silk clothing from one of the thousands of boat graves in Viking-rich Scandinavia. Scholars originally believed the silks were Viking-age burial clothes and didn't give the garments a second look.
And I'm a textile archaeologist, so I'm mostly interested in the textiles, and I have for 20 years wondered why there are so lot of silks in these graves.
More than 100 years would go by before Dr. Annika Larsson, a textile archaeologist, would discover the Arabic lettering woven into the silks that could change the way we perceive these European pirates. Larsson believes she's found the word Allah written in the ancient Arabic text of Kufic, woven into one of the silks found in the Viking boat grave, which dates back to the 9th century. This discovery gives rise to the notion that Vikings, at least in this case, may have even practiced Islam. But Larsson says there's still more research to do.
If you look to the text sources, they say they maybe have practiced it. If we can, we are in the middle of this research project. So I hope in the future maybe we can tell if some of them were practicing some kind of Islam.
Not everyone is convinced of Dr. Larsson's findings. That could be because of the Kufic lettering.
Because one of the things we do know about this Kufic script, which is just one type of calligraphy.
Dr. Lewis Haas is a professor at Middle Tennessee State University.
In all of our rendering Arabic, that we'll see this in late medieval, early Renaissance painting, that all kind of paintings of various people from Europe's interpretation of the time of Christ, like the Virgin Mary. We'll see Kufic script on them, and especially these headband things.
Haas specializes in medieval Europe, the Crusades, and Islam.
They do actually have Kufic script, or stuff that, at least to the Christian artists, look like Kufic. It's, there's even kind of a concept of false Kufic or whatever, where it's just a Christian trying to draw like that, because they think what they're trying to do is simply this, and maybe it's some sort of writing that was maybe contemporary with Jesus. So to be accurate, I'll try to do something like that. It's one of these things where a lot of times when you dig something up literally, or whatever, it's like it actually offers way more questions than answers.
Other scholars want to ensure there's enough evidence before jumping to any conclusions on the matter. Some have even brought up white supremacists as a reason not to immediately accept Dr. Larsson's findings. The Atlantic recently published a story quoting experts who warned that people being credulous of Larsson's claim may be guided less by solid evidence than by a political motivation, which is the desire to stick it to white supremacists.
One's country determined by race of a sort, or interpretation of race, race itself being more culturally defined rather than biological. Just how do people feel about this, and kind of people coming in and who they are. For America as an immigrant nation, at one level, we don't really have these questions, but at another level, we have these questions intensely beyond imagination. Europe, in some ways, had never been much of an immigrant nation per se, until just as of late, let's say last 50 years more so. They have all the, so those questions are kind of coming into a head. And, of course, also Europe has its own levels of anti-Semitism, various other things. And for then someone to say, well, maybe you're not quite as pure as you thought. Maybe there was more mingling than you thought. It kind of strikes at the heart of their position, mm-hmm. and they kind of get a little agitated by that in various ways. For the so-called white supremacists, what this does is it kind of strikes at the heart of what they want to believe. Kind of strikes at a core of a belief they have about an imagined past.
One thing's for sure, the burial practice does indicate quite a bit of importance to the story. Because even if this person did not know exactly what the garment writings meant, according to the historical archaeologist Martin Rundqvist, who's written extensively on Swedish boat graves and their landscape, the simple fact that this woman had been buried in a boat grave suggests she was an elite member of the community.
Especially when you bury somebody with something, this is always important. You're never going to do something on whim. You know, it always means something. It's something deliberate. You know, a lot of times, you know, especially when you're going off into the next world, whether it is, you're not going to take chances.
For her to enter the next life with these symbols, Dr. Larson believes, is quite telling.
I think people put someone in the grave with a lot of objects. They are thinking of something in the future as well. And if they put a lot of silk there with special patterns from Persia and China, I think they would have meant something to these people.
So did Vikings practice Islam? Larson can't say for sure. One thing that's interesting, Larson and her associates are working on some DNA testing, and they should get the results in February. Needless to say, we'll be sure to keep tabs on this story for you guys. For RTN Theology, I'm Ian Scotta.
David Childers and the Serpents of Reformation, Life of Jesus, available on iTunes. Well, it's a great honor to be joined today by my good friend, David Childers. David, how are you today?
Oh, it's great to be here, Bob. Merry Christmas.
Here we are, David. The very beginning of the season of Advent. What does this time of year mean to you?
Well, I you're going to put me in hot water. I don't know that I've been all that denying of myself. Of course, I don't have too much to deny, but it's a period. I always take it seriously. It's a period of preparation for a spiritual reawakening. I'm a Christian, so... you know, the birth of Christ celebrated on December 25th. Whether or not that's an actual date, I mean, it doesn't matter to me. It's what I've done all my life. It's an important time to prepare our hearts, prepare our outlook, and you know, trying to get ready for the Christ child to enter us and maybe make us a little bit better than we are.
You've written and recorded two of my most favorite gospel albums of all time. One of them is called Blessed in an Unusual Way. The other is the recent Serpents of Reformation you did. Could you tell us about your gospel records?
Well, let's see. It was before Run, Skeleton, Run. I did an album with Robert Childers and Neil Harper and a cast of different people coming in and playing. We didn't know it was even going to be a gospel record, but for some reason, Robert Childers took it in that direction. Him being a self-proclaimed pagan and atheist, I was a bit taken aback, but you know, the Lord, from my perspective, the Lord knows how to use us. And so I went along with it, and it was a pretty amazing record. My name's on it, but it's a lot more than me to that record. And I think that's very reflective of what you get in a religious situation, even like a church. It was just, we weren't intending that to happen. It just happened. I like to think because the Holy Spirit was in there guiding us. Take that or leave it. I don't care if people want to believe it or not. That's what I think. So, and a very obscure record. I mean, it didn't make any waves. It didn't get listened to. But a few people picked up on it, and a bunch of chaplains, bishops from the Episcopal Church, got a hold of it and were very encouraging, had us come actually play at a few functions, which I found to be an honor and an amazing spiritual experience. I'm suspicious of churches and religion on the whole, but what I'm dealing with is not really so much religion as it is my own spiritual being. And my own spiritual personality, I guess.
David, there are so many great songs connected to this season. Are there any for you that are just really special?
Yeah, there's ones I'm always going back to this time of year. The Holly and the Ivy, it's an ancient song. Same with Good King Wenceslas, which came out of Slovakia, I believe, and it's about a good-hearted king who cares for his people, and he sees this beggar man, finds out where he lives, and takes a bunch of wine and meat to him out at his little old hovel where he lives in the snowstorm. And at one point, his squire or page, who's with him, says, "Yeah, I'm getting cold, man. I'm tired. This is just too much. I can't stand this weather." And Wenceslas says, "You know, take heart and come along, and you'll find that you know, the heat's in you, and the Lord's going to take care of you." And it ends with, "Ye now will bless the poor, shall yourself find blessing." And that's at the core of Christianity. That's the heart of it right there. But it's a cool tune, you know, and I always liked the tune. I was drawn to it before I was actually drawn to the words.
David, thank you so much for speaking with me today, and the best wishes of the season to you and your family.
We send our love back to you and your family, Bob.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. We'd like to thank Jeff Crawford for letting us use some of the music from the Christmas Nights EP, music from the Gathering Church. Please check it out on iTunes. We'd also like to thank Dolph Ramsour for recording David Childers in our closing song today. On behalf of everyone here at RTM Productions, we wish you all a Merry Christmas, a Happy Hanukkah, a Happy Kwanzaa, and the healthiest, happiest season you could possibly imagine.
Good King Wenceslas looked down on the feast of Stephen, when the snow lay round about, deep and crisp and even, brightly shone the moon that night. Though the frost was cruel, when a poor man came in sight, gathering winter fuel. Hither, page, and stand by me, if thou knowest telling, yonder poor man, who is he? Where and what's his dwelling? Sire, he lives a goodly hence, underneath the mountain, right beside the forest fence, by St. Agnes' fountain. Bring me flesh and bring me wine, bring me pine logs hither. Thou and I will see him dine when we bear them thither. Page and monarch, forth they went together, through the rude wind's wild lament and the bitter weather. Sire, the night grows darker and the wind grows stronger. Marks my strength, I know not how, I can go no longer. Mark my footsteps, my good page, tread thou in them boldly. Thou shalt find the winter rage freeze thy blood less coldly. In his master's steps he trod, where the snow lay dented. Heat was in the very sod which the saint had printed. Therefore, Christian men, be sure, wealth or rank possessing, he who now will bless the poor shall yourselves find blessing.